From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's the Frames Summer Movies Special. For many fans, summer and the movies is almost a ritual.
Watching a movie with a community, with people you have nothing in common with, it is kind of like going to a place of worship.
Kamail Nanjiani helps us preview what's coming to theaters this season, like his action comedy Stuber. Emma Thompson co-stars with Mindy Kaling in Late Night, and actress Olivia Wilde directs Booksmart, her first movie.
It's not a comedy that just takes jokes written for guys and putting them in the mouths of actresses.
Quentin Tarantino recreates 1969 Hollywood, and what's up with all the horror films this summer?
I think especially when we're in somewhat traumatic times politically, that might have something to do with what's feeding the horror frenzy.
And we'll sample some new snacks for the concession stand. I'm John Horn. It's summertime at the movies. Stick around.
Mark thy calendars and make thy plans to attend the drama department's summer program, Shakespeare in the Park, King Lot.
Catching up on my daily meditation.
Time for lunch, I think. You hungry?
It's 9:30.
It's to infinity and beyond.
You gonna be the next Iron Man now?
Well, no, I don't have time. I'm too busy doing your job.
Is that how you describe your job, Cliff?
Who's asking?
John Chef Jr.
World domination ain't pretty.
Junior? He really is Black Superman.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
I have concocted a plan.
Let's go to Nick's party.
You're coming with us.
Welcome to the Frame Summer Movie Special. I'm John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jen Yamato, film writer at the LA Times. And we are going to spend the next 50 or so minutes doing a little summer movie party here.
We've got a new Spider-Man movie, a new Fast and the Furious spinoff.
You've got a Secret Life of Pets 2, your Annabelle 3, your Toy Story 4.
And then amidst all those remakes and sequels and spinoffs, there's going to be some new original movies like Stuber.
Stuber is an LA-set action comedy, kind of in the vein of Lethal Weapon, that stars Kumail Nanjiani, who you will know as the star and writer of the autobiographical romantic comedy The Big Sick.
And it co-stars Dave Bautista. He's a wrestler who's turned actor. He's probably best known for playing Drax in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. He's also been in the Avengers. Anyway, what is Stuber about? Let's have Kumail Nanjiani explain it.
Okay, so an Uber driver gets kidnapped by a cop and forced to go on an all-night adventure to catch a murderous drug dealer. And the cop can't see.
Because he just got LASIK.
He just got LASIK.
Hi, ladies.
What the hell's going on?
You selected the Uber pool option.
Uber what? Ladies, official police business.
Is that even real? So after The Big Sick, I decided that the only way I wouldn't put too much pressure on myself was to do something completely different that nobody could compare to The Big Sick, right? So then this script came in and I read it and I thought it was really fun and funny. But I was like, if I want to do like an action comedy with guns and all this stuff, there has to be a reason for it to exist. Like, it can't just be that it's entertaining. And so I actually talked to Fox a bunch about it and was like, hey, I think there's some like underlying themes in this movie that I think we should really bring up to the surface that you don't normally see in like a big action movie like this that seems like such a guy movie, you know?
Like toxic masculinity and men talking about their feelings.
Exactly, exactly. I was like, if we're doing a movie in 2019 about angry dudes with guns, we have to talk about that.
Well, and what Stuber has that none of the summer blockbusters, certainly the studio blockbusters have, are two leads like you and Dave Bautista. There is some really smart writing, I think, baked into the banter between your two characters about race and about perception, especially when it comes to Dave Bautista, who not a lot of people know is of Filipino heritage.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I mean, two like people of color as the leads of like a studio action comedy. You don't really see that often, you know? I mean, those Bad Boys and I guess Rush Hour, but I think what's interesting about it is, so my character has racist stuff happen to him, but through the course of the whole movie, he's trying to label other people too. Like, there's a moment that happens where he's trying to explain to an Asian person what Uber is, and she's like, yeah, dude, we know what Uber is. So he's guilty of the same stuff that he's sort of the victim of.
You are coming out in the summer, and it's so rare to have a studio movie that is an original story come out between what is a typical summer movie season. Do you think there's extra weight on a movie like Stuber, given the way that the summer movie is lining up and how you find an audience amidst all those big blockbusters?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's terrifying. We're coming out a week after Spider-Man Far From Home and a week before Lion King. I mean, it could not. We have like one shot at it. The Big Sick came out in the summer, and that was very, very difficult. We actually went wide the same day that Spider-Man Homecoming came out. So I've battled Spider-Man before. We're old foes. You know, there's a sense that certain movies are theater movies and certain movies are not theater movies. I think comedies are theater movies, too. I think the shared experience of watching a movie with a community, with people you have nothing in common with, it is kind of like going to a place of worship. It's kind of like going to church.
That was Kumail Nanjiani. His movie Stuber comes out July 12th. And this is the Frame's summer movie special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Jen Yamato, film writer for the LA Times.
And I am John Horn, the host of The Frame on KPCC. Now, Jen, when you go to the multiplex, you do one other thing besides see a movie.
You get snacks.
You get incredibly nutritious snacks filled with sodium and sugar.
Delicious.
So at this theater owners convention a couple weeks ago called CinemaCon, I met up with one of The Frame's contributors, Marcos Najera, and we decided to take a walk around the trade floor where all of the new concessions are being introduced, and we ended up at one place that we couldn't quite leave.
Heaven in a room!
It is, as long as you're not counting calories. So Marcos, you've never been to CinemaCon before.
Never.
So downstairs in the big Coliseum where Celine Dion performs, that's where the studios show all of their previews of upcoming films. Here's the fun part, because it's concessions from here as far as the eye can see. I think we should check out some snacks.
You know I'm in the middle of a juice cleanse right now, John.
That's very bad timing. So
not well planned.
Let's go check it out.
Let's go. So, John, I have to admit to you, while you were in your presentation earlier, I snuck down here as soon as I got here from the airport just to kind of get the lay of the land. So I have a couple of favorites.
I'm going to follow you, so you can be my guide. Where are we starting?
The place that I was drawn to first, it's a little old school, but are you a fan of the Cheetos?
Does Cheetos have a booth?
Does Cheetos have a booth? This guy. Okay, this way. Move past the hummus, move past the strawberry banana smoothie.
I see something glowing orange.
It's like a concentrated oil that tastes like Cheetos, and then you add the Cheetos in here, and then this one has also another one of our brands, which is Smart Foods, and then it has caramel in it. Yeah.
That's an amazing color. Isn't that awesome?
Amazing is one word for it, yes. And this one looks like Doritos with cheese sauce.
Doritos Flaming Hot Nachos Nacho.
Is it good?
Are they really good? Are these brand new?
The caramel, it's like a brand new mix. We launched it in Regal last year, and it's doing amazing. And then this is like a brand new chip for us.
These colors are amazing, John. This one's like fire engine red.
And it's really spicy. I think we have to go from here to some sort of beverage.
Before we walk off, I gotta ask her, what color is this?
Bright orange.
Is that the official Cheetos color name?
Orange. Definitely orange, yeah.
Orange flavored popcorn.
Tastes as good as it sounds.
You know, I recently went to a Regal Cinemas and saw an advertisement for Flamin' Hot Cheetos popcorn, and I was like, yes, this is the future that I asked for.
Yeah, but you need like an icy to wash it down with. So it's like one thing begets another, and before you know it, you've had like 2,000 calories, and the movie hasn't even started yet.
Okay, John, so to get in the headspace for this next film we're going to discuss, we have to go back 50 years. To 1969 Hollywood.
To my right is Bounty Law series lead and Jake Cahill himself, Rick Dalton. And to my left is Rick Stutt double Cliff Booth.
Leonardo DiCaprio is an actor who's stuck in the TV westerns. Brad Pitt is his stunt double / BFF. Margot Robbie is his neighbor, who happens to be the actress Sharon Tate, who we all know will have a run-in with the Manson family in 1969. It's all part of the new Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Tarantino has done a lot of period films. 1969 Hollywood is very specific, and we wondered how he pulled it off. So we sent Tim Grieving to find out.
Basically, you start with reality and we put fantasy on top of it.
I meet location manager Rick Schuler and production designer Barbara Ling at a very 2019 Starbucks on the corner of Sunset and Gower. We all hop in a car together, and they take me on a trip through Hollywood back in time.
Hollywood is a destination now, and we wanted to create more than that. It's like you get here and you go, well, where is Hollywood? Well, it's kind of an idea. And this movie was making it a place more so than anything else has done before.
Right now in front of what is now the Aquarius Theater, rebirthed on Sunset Boulevard. We recreated at least one section of the building. This is where Hair premiered in the 60s. We had painters doing this, and they told me, they said, you know, this has to be the most fun project because people stop all day long and just scream up to them, thank you for putting it back.
We drive down Sunset and stop in front of the famous Cinerama Dome.
Barbara, were you surprised at how any of these places retained their 50-year-old characteristics, or was it a huge to-do to turn back time?
It was a huge to-do to turn back time. It's unfortunate that in L.A. we tear down as much as and as fast as we can of any of the old iconic pieces. The few that we have left, like the Cinerama Dome, the very facade, the marquee is still the original, and the golf ball top. But of course, in that time frame, there was nothing but parking lots on either side of it. So you have, you know, we did the premiere of Krakatoa here, but you could only shoot tight in because you had, of course, this whole world around it now that looks nothing like the 60s, but at least there's a little piece of something left. But that was rare.
Now we're in the touristy heart of Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard, tempted to go inside a famous restaurant for a midday martini.
Musso and Frank's featured in a big way in the movie. We repainted and did all kinds of things there. The nice thing about that restaurant is that they've preserved pretty much the integrity of everything that's there, from the leather and the booths to all of that kind of stuff. So that was a wonderful gem to find. What's to the left of it, however, the Cabo Cantina, all of that got stripped off, from the straw awning to all the signage and everything. And the Vogue Theater used to extend in front of that. So we put the Vogue Theater back in right there. And then over here, or in front of Barbara, at this hologram place here, we used to be the Pussycat Theater. And we turned that back to the Pussycat, put the whole facade back on there. And people were like, whoa, what is this?
Where are we now?
So we're El Coyote, which has a lot of pieces left of the original facade. And it's extremely iconic place in the 60s. So it was a must for Quentin, who I might add still loves going to, you know, he still, you know, Musso's gave us the longest shutdown of anyone ever trying, because he actually, in everyday life, loves going to Musso's. So they're, you know, he's a customer that they know well.
With him, it's kind of watching him like a kid in a toy shop with this movie at some level, because it was such a walk down memory lane for him. And he loves movies. He breathes movies.
Rick Schuler and Barbara Lang are a location manager and the production designer on Quentin Tarantino's movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It opens July 26th, and that piece was produced by Tim Grieving.
Coming up, Octavia Spencer stars in a horror film, but that's not the only scary movie coming to theaters this summer.
And the Beatles, Bruce Springsteen, and Elton John all get top billing in three very different movies. We've got all that and more coming up on the Frame Summer Movie Special from KPCC in Los Angeles, so stick around. Welcome back to the Frame Summer Movie Special from the studios of KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame.
And I'm Jen Yamato, film writer for the LA Times. Now, John, one movie everybody's really curious about this summer is Rocket Man. Rocket Man, burning out his fuse out of everyone. This film is directed by Dexter Fletcher, who took over for Bryan Singer when Bryan Singer was fired off of Bohemian Rhapsody, which did really, really well. And this movie hopes to do for Elton John what that movie did for Queen.
So Rocketman is about Elton John's kind of arrival on the scene. And there's a key moment that happened right here in L.A. Specifically, it's at the Troubadour in West Hollywood, where Elton John makes his U.S. debut in 1970. So I went out to the Troubadour and I met up with Robert Hilburn, who was at the time when Elton John did the show in 1970, the brand new baby pop music critic at the LA Times. And he talked about his very vivid memories of seeing Elton John, who was only 23 at the time, play his first show in the United States.
So I sit down, Elton comes out. Almost shyly, you know, I almost thought it was a roadie or something coming out at first. He has just a t-shirt on, nothing's fancy. He's looking down at the piano, he's singing. He's not looking out at the audience, he's not reaching out at the audience. He didn't seem to have the confidence, didn't seem to have the flair. And a guy next to me in the industry sent me a note. And he said, "I think I'll pass on this guy." And that was the early feeling in the room. Then all of a sudden, 15, 30 minutes into the 45-minute set, he stood up. It was like lightning strikes. He kicks over the piano bench and starts playing Burn Down the Mission, a really rock and roll type of song, looking like Jerry Lee Lewis. And I went, wow. He can be an entertainer as well as a great songwriter, and that was kind of the turning point.
I'm going to ask you to read from your review. It starts right here.
His music is so staggeringly original, look at that, boy, I'm being impressed, that it's obvious he's not merely operating within a given musical feel, such as country or blues or rock, but like Randy Newman or Laura Nyro, among others, he's creating his own field. That's because he was pop rock. He wasn't the Hendrix. He wasn't the Dylan. He wasn't any of those guys. He was something new. And that's what the 70s brought, kind of, you know, a new, softer sound. And he was right at the forefront of that.
Part of the premise of the film Rocket Man is that this concert at the Troubadour was a turning point in Elton John's career. Do you buy that?
Oh, of course. He was unknown before he stepped on that stage. The next morning after the review ran, I got calls from promoters across the country. I don't know how they found out about the country, that there was no internet, but I guess that people Xeroxed them stuff. He left the stage a star.
They got it by carrier pigeon. There wasn't even Xerox back there. I'm going to ask you to read the end of your review.
By the end of the evening, there was no question about John's talent and potential. Tuesday night at the Troubadour was just the beginning. He's going to be one of rock's biggest and most important stars. It's interesting. I put one of. I didn't say he was going to be the.
Bob Hilburn, great to see you. Thanks for coming
on
the show.
Okay, yeah, John. Good to see you.
That was Bob Hilburn. He's the LA Times pop music critic emeritus. Rocket Man, starring Taron Egerton as Elton John, comes out on May 31st.
You're listening to the Frame Summer Movie Special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Jen Yamato from the LA Times. I'm here with John Horn, host of The Frame. And we're about to talk about a movie called Blinded by the Light, another of the summer's musical offerings, which has a lot of tunes by this guy.
I've done my best to live the right way.
That, of course, is Bruce Springsteen. The movie is set in the late 1980s, and it's directed by Gurinder Chadha. She made a movie called Bend It Like Beckham that was about, not David Beckham, but a young woman who was obsessed with David Beckham.
Blinded by the Light is based on Safraz Manzoor's biography, Greetings from Bury Park, and he also has a writing credit on the film. As a teenager, he found that listening to The Boss actually helped him deal with his own experiences as a child of immigrants from Pakistan. But we'll have him tell you about it.
It was the fall of 1987, and I was 16 years old, and somebody who I had worked with had a friend, and she introduced me to him. I remember he had a turban on, he was wearing a denim jacket, and he was listening to some music. And I asked him, you know, what are you listening to? And he said, Bruce Springsteen. And I was quite sort of, cocky, kind of slightly surprised by that. And I was also quite cocky, and I said, Bruce Springsteen, isn't he that guy who wears check shirts and makes millions out of pretending to be working class? But he just looked at me and he just like, you're an idiot, you know nothing. And he said, Springsteen is the direct line to all that's true in the world. I just wasn't that persuaded. But then he basically said, look, you're an idiot, but I can help you. And he gave me a couple of cassettes. And that night I listened. And the song, I suppose, that particularly kind of affected me was Independence Day. Because in Independence Day, he's talking about his dad, but he's talking about him with a place of empathy, saying, look, it's just different people and they see things in different ways. And, you know, I never wanted to take those things away. And I just had never heard anything like this. And I remember thinking, this is like a story that's unfolding and I kind of want to know what happens next. And you can't touch me now. They ain't gonna do to me what I watch them do to you. I mean, my dad was, you know, a working class immigrant. He came from Pakistan in 1963. And, you know, he came and he left the country because he wanted a better life. You know, and when you're 16, you're not really somebody who spends that much time thinking about your parents as human beings. You know, you think of them as figures of opposition. And then I started hearing Springsteen, and I remember thinking, this is somebody who's trying to see the guy who's his dad as a human being who just sees the world differently. And that kind of really, that was really helpful for me. And for me, the book is kind of a love letter to Springsteen, but it's also a love letter to my parents and about that world that they came from. And after I wrote it, I was like, you know, it'd be amazing to try and get it to Bruce. The book came out, I think, in 2007, and a couple of years later he was going to be coming to London, and I got a ticket to go, and I brought the copy of the book with me. In the years previous to that, I'd been to see him so often that I had run into him a number of times, you know, not in a kind of professional capacity, but just outside hotels or just, you know, he'd spot me on the front row and things because I was there so often. So I wouldn't say that he knew me, but he recognized me enough. And so I had the book with me, and then he comes past all the paparazzi and the flashing bulbs and stuff in the bar area. And then suddenly he spots me. I can see him walking towards me, and he walks towards me, and then he just says, your book was really beautiful. And I just absolutely just collapsed. I was shrieking, and I'm like, you've read the book. And he goes, people send it to me all the time. It's a really beautiful thing. It was such an incredible thing to write something about what this guy means to me. And then for him to acknowledge that he'd actually read it was just such a surreal experience. And so that was what sort of set me on the journey towards thinking that the idea of a film was possible. Madman, drummers, bombers, and Indians in the summer with a
teenage diplomat. That was Sarfraz Manzoor telling us about the new film based on his life, Blinded by the Light, which comes out on August 14th. But John, I know you saw another of this summer's musical films, directed by Danny Boyle. It's called Yesterday. All my troubles
seem so far away. So this is a kind of a crazy concept. The idea is there's some sort of global blackout. There's this struggling musician. He has a bike accident. When he wakes up, only he has remembered the music of the Beatles. They have vanished from history. You can't find them in record stores. You can't Google them. So he decides he's going to pass off their music as his own. And the actor who plays this young singer is a guy named Himesh Patel. I said something wrong. Now
I long for yesterday. What the hell was that?
Yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
The Beatles.
The what?
How would you describe the way that your character, Jack, approaches these songs? Because, again, the conceit is nobody knows them. But it's not as if he's trying to replicate what the Beatles sounded like.
Not only do people not know them, they don't exist. So he has absolutely no reference point for where to even begin. It's all from his mind. And that was the real joy of working with Daniel Pemberton, who was our composer, and his friend Ardem Ilhan, who came in, and we worked together for 2 months, basically, in this room that we converted in the offices in London to make it look like Jack's bedroom. We put posters up on the wall and a piano and a Wurlitzer and a record player, and I spent 2 months in that room with Ardem just learning the songs, getting better at playing guitar and piano, and just working it out with Danny, you know, what's best for the film.
And how important is it that you'd forget, essentially, what it was that the Beatles did with the music and make it your own? Is it always something that you're hearing in the back of your head, or are you able to really divorce it and shut that out?
I think they'll always be there because, you know, you don't want to veer too far from it. And also, the songs are just so amazing that you can never separate them from those four. And in a way, that's what we're saying with our film, is that, you know, even if they don't exist, you can't recreate them to be anything better than what the four of them did. When I was younger, so
much younger than today. That was Himesh Patel. He's the star of Yesterday. It comes out on June 28th.
You're listening to the Frame Summer Movie Special from KPCC. I am Jen Yamato, film writer for the LA Times.
And I'm John Horn, the host of the Frame. Jen, I want to say that I did not stop with the nacho-flavored popcorn and the Doritos.
Good.
I kept going. Here's the next installment in my culinary travels at CinemaCon with Frame contributor Marcos Najera. This one is about a company called Good to Grow.
We're a licensed kids' juice company, and this is a spill-proof sippy cup topper, mess-free. We have three profiles, so the first one is 100% juice, so all the sugar that's in the bottle comes from the fruit. The second one is a fruit and vegetable blend. It kind of teases them into eating the vegetables. They don't even realize they're drinking them. And then we have a low-sugar organic. Also, this is a screw-off top, and the toy actually stays in this little dome. This is something that we trademarked. We call it Pods. This allows the kids to display their collection. They're stackable.
I love how you're laughing right now, John.
The whole idea of a collectible top.
Believe me, we have a cult following. We have a website called Good to Collect.
Water, apple and carrot and beet juice, concentrate, citric acid, ascorbic acid, natural tropical fruit flavors.
Sounds good for the body, John.
And it's got a little Thomas the Tank Engine.
Just peel that off and suck.
It's really good.
I'll be honest, when I heard the name of this business, Good to Grow, I thought that this was the next frontier in movie snackage, was CBD and marijuana industries finally breaking into the movie-going experience.
Right. Those red vines taste especially tasty. What could be in them?
Ooh, and I feel so much calmer. It's helping me cope with this terrible, terrible movie that I paid a lot of money to go see. You know, it's not a bad idea, so maybe we'll see that next year at CinemaCon. I think CBD popcorn could certainly help people not just cope with bad movies, but scary movies, like the ones that we're about to talk about.
To talk about horror, we invited Tanana Reeve Du into the studios. She's a filmmaker and a professor at UCLA. She's an expert in genre films and teaches a class on Black horror. Tanana Reeve, welcome.
So great to be here.
So here's a question I have for both of you. Scary movies have been around forever. Scary movies in the summer, relatively new idea. So what's happening? What's changing?
Well, I think we all think horror movies, and naturally we think Halloween. You think fall. You think, you know, scary movie season is traditionally not in the summer, but studios are seeing that that is now changed because the audience hunger for genre movies is so, so vast.
I agree, you know, and I think especially when we're in somewhat traumatic times politically, that might have something to do with what's feeding the horror frenzy. We can extract some of that trauma out and watch strangers suffer and root for them. And, you know, occasionally they win. And there's no substitute for digging your fingers, you know, into the arm of the person sitting next to you. And you can't do that with strangers. So you have to bring someone to do that with.
And we're seeing a real spectrum of horror titles. A superhero horror movie hybrid called Brightburn, which is actually really quite gory. Mm. We've got Child's Play, which is going to confuse fans of the classic Child's Play because those rights are actually technically split between two studios. So this is a remake of the original Child's Play.
Does it have Chucky?
It has a version of Chucky.
You know, but I have to say, I saw the expanded trailer, and I think the expanded trailer is really intriguing.
Buddy can connect to and control all of your Caslin products and smart home devices. Introducing your new best friend.
I'm really curious to see if people take to a version of Chucky where the explanation is he is AI gone wrong.
That's fine by me. Yeah. We're all struggling with our gadgets.
It's so true. Yeah. People who loved Ari Aster's Hereditary last year will see Midsommar this year.
They are a proven team, and I will see everything they do.
There's one scary movie that all of us have seen, and that's Ma. It has Octavia Spencer in the starring role as Sue Ann or Ma. The trailer gives a lot away.
It does.
And that we don't really get into a lot of her motivation, but we know that she befriends some kids who want a place to go party. And let's just say the parties don't really work out the way that the kids hope that they might.
Right.
The bar is open.
What do you think?
We don't know this chick.
It ain't much, but it's all you.
Cool basement.
You're free to do whatever you want down here, but nobody go upstairs.
This is so sick.
Welcome to Ma's.
I love that you see the posters for Ma, and it is just Octavia's face. It's a really interesting thing to see Oscar-caliber actresses take on roles like this in genre when genre has the power to really explode a lot of societal things and themes that you don't maybe expect. So that was what I was hoping to get out of Ma. You see the trailer, it's set up in what appears to be a predominantly white town. Here comes Ma. She's gonna buy all your teenagers alcohol, but give them a safe space to party. You know, it's a good setup for a movie. Tanana Reeve, what'd you think?
It is a good setup. And I remember when the trailer first came out, there was so much excitement around it and that poster that you're talking about. And seeing a Black woman showcased that way, that a meme was created from that poster, which was, I will, for radio, I'll say, F them kids. And that really went around because of the idea of revenge horror, which has its appeal. I mean, here's a woman, you can tell from the trailer, who has been invisible and has been not treated well, and she's getting her revenge. So that's a pretty classic revenge horror setup. But what I'm really happy about is that Ma is showing that this idea that Blacks can star in horror movies and be a part of a genre is alive and well.
That was UCLA professor and absolute genre expert Tanana Reeve Du. She's also a filmmaker, one of the producers behind the Shudder streaming documentary Horror Noir.
Octavia Spencer's movie Ma hits theaters on May 31st.
Coming up, Emma Thompson co-stars with Mindy Kaling in the film Late Night, which is a movie that Kaling actually wrote with Emma Thompson in mind.
Anything that's been written for me, I'm always in a corset being earnest and kind. So luckily I wasn't. I was in a blazer with slick back hair being incredibly mean most of the time.
And Olivia Wilde goes behind the camera to direct a teen comedy about two best friends on the verge of graduating from high school.
I love that in our film it's about two smart women who aren't trying to transform. There's no kind of makeover montage where they become just like the popular kids.
All that and more coming up on the Frame Summer Movie Special from KPCC. Stick around.
Welcome back. This is the Frame Summer Movie Special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Jen Yamato of the LA Times.
And I'm John Horn, host of The Frame. And in this part of the show, we're going to talk about a bunch of movies coming out this summer that were directed by women and are not sequels, spin-offs, reboots, you know, superhero summer stuff.
Sure, but first, John, we do have to take a moment to address those sequels, reboots, et cetera, that are going to be in the theaters this summer. So here's my challenge to you. What are one or two of these movies that you are curious about?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you know my taste. I'd rather see something new and original. So that said, I guess I'd be interested in seeing The Lion King, Jon Favreau's live-action reimagining of the Disney animated film. And then it gets a little dicey. Maybe Annabelle. I like that series. I think those movies are pretty good as scary movies go.
That's so interesting. I would not have pegged you for an Annabeller.
Everything you see in here is either haunted, cursed, or has been used in some kind of ritualistic practice. Nothing's a toy. It's safer for these things to be in here than out there.
Speaking of all of these kinds of movies, one movie I will absolutely be going to see, even though hashtag justice for Han lives on in my heart, is Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, which is the Fast and Furious spinoff starring The Rock.
Mama, where's all our guns?
I get rid of them.
Very noble, Mrs. Hobbs.
And Jason Statham, whose character, need I remind you, killed Han. So, you know, they have a lot of splaining to do for me. One of the other movies I think is interesting, will be interesting to see, is Disney's Aladdin. I think Aladdin is a movie that so far I think Disney is very acutely aware of backlash to. If you notice around town, after the backlash to Blue Will Smith, he's not blue in the ads anymore.
You make me a prince?
There is a lot of gray area in make me a prince. I could just make you a prince.
Oh, no.
Right, you'd be snuggled up with that dude for the rest of your life.
Y'all see my palace?
Be specific with your words.
It's an interesting director, Guy Ritchie, who is kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. He made some really good mobster movies early in his career. Then he did the Sherlock Holmes movies, one of which was good. But I agree. If there was a big movie in the summer that I think people are worried about, it might be Disney's live-action version of Aladdin.
We shall see.
So let's switch gears. We all know mobster movies that have been around forever, but this summer there's a twist on that genre.
The Kitchen stars a trio of some of Hollywood's most talented women. Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Elizabeth Moss star in this movie based on a graphic novel that was adapted and directed by Andrea Berloff.
Andrea Berloff actually got an Oscar nomination for writing on Straight Outta Compton. Here's her elevator pitch for The Kitchen.
Three amazing women, when their men are carted off to jail, have to take over the Irish mafia, and they end up running it in a much more vicious way than the men ever did.
What were the conventions of how women are seen in this world that you kept in mind, that you wanted to bring in so that you could sort of explode them?
When you stick a gun in a woman's hand, it says something. And I didn't want it just to be them behaving like men. I wanted them to behave like women. So to me, that meant they're going to collaborate a lot more than men and not feel threatened by each other in the way that men in a mob story might feel threatened by one another. There is power to share. And I wanted to think about how women can use that power, how a gun is not the only thing that is powerful. Our minds are the most powerful things that we have. And I wanted to give those women a chance to really be one step ahead of everybody else around them.
Well, and what I would say is one of the kind of themes of the graphic novel is that these women at every turn are underestimated, that people don't think they're capable of doing many things, including violence, including being organized, including doing what they define as men's work. And I'm wondering if that was something that you felt really important too, to challenge this idea that you can look at somebody and say they're not capable of doing something that actually they are capable of doing.
Absolutely. And isn't that a theme for our time?
Isn't that
isn't that a theme for don't underestimate me just because I've been a writer for 15 years doesn't mean I can't be a director. Don't underestimate women from the jobs that they can do. Don't underestimate anybody. And I hope that audiences can really connect to that feeling of, yeah, why can't I do it? Why can't funny ladies do drama? So it's really trying to subvert that idea of society wants to put us all in a box, whatever that box might be. And that's a really uncomfortable place to live.
Andrea Berloff is the writer and director of The Kitchen. It comes to theaters on August 9th.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to the Frame Summer Movie Special from KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Jen Yamato of the LA Times. And I'm here with John Horn, the host of The Frame.
So, Jen, our next film is the directorial debut of actress Olivia Wilde. It's a teen comedy, and it's called Booksmart.
This is one of my most anticipated of the summer. It's about two girls who are best friends who realize on the very last day of senior year that they might have missed out on something in high school.
We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Okay. We've broken a lot of rules. One, we have fake IDs.
Fake college IDs so we can get into their 24-hour library.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
Yes, he broke art rules. Name a person who broke a real rule.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
one. Susan B. Anthony.
Here's Olivia Wilde with the teen movies that she referenced going in to direct Booksmart.
I grew up watching and rewatching all of John Hughes' films, but specifically The Breakfast Club.
Shut up!
You're just feeling sorry for yourself.
Yeah, if I didn't, nobody else would.
Oh, you're breaking my heart.
Aside from that, really Say Anything, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Dazed and Confused, and then all the way up to Clueless. And I think what all those films seem to have in common to me, they're all kind of generational anthems. They are comments on their time, but they're using universal themes. And one of the reasons I really wanted to tell one of those stories is I imagine being young right now must be really, really hard.
It's no easier than it was when we were teenagers.
But maybe even more difficult.
That's quite true.
I mean, let's not beat around the bush. It's like it's actually dangerous to be in school now. We weren't doing active shooter drills. Like, this is a new kind of subconscious level of anxiety that exists for young people. And combined with social media, combined with kind of the political landscape of right now and how divisive everything is, truly, it must be very stressful to be young. And I wanted to make something that said, enjoy this. You are young. Imagine if your problems were still just about getting into college and what party you get to go to and kind of finding yourself. So in some senses, I wanted to make something simple in the way that Dazed and Confused was a simple story with an amazing ensemble that made me feel excited to be young.
Olivia Wilde directed Booksmart, and it is in theaters starting May 24th.
Okay, Jen, I have one more piece of tape I want to play you from my trip with producer Marcos Nájera to the trade show floor at CinemaCon in Las Vegas. This last one, very tasty, but the thing you would only eat in a movie theater.
Did you actually eat your way across the showroom floor?
Yeah, it's really bad.
Amazing.
I have to say, I saw something in the program. Something called, I'm going to say Tacatitos or Taquitos. Can we find that booth? John, that wasn't even close. Tequecitos. Okay, Tacatitos. Again, not close. It's a Venezuelan snack, and they're trying to bring it here to the U.S. And are you ready to try a tequecito?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Okay. Hey, Peter, good to see you again, Marcos.
Glad to
from
see
KPCC.
Marcos.
This is John Horn.
Hi, John, how are you?
John, how are you?
Do you mind telling him a little bit about the story about the woman when she invented them?
Okay, yes. At the beginning of the, say, last century, 20th century, there was a lady cooking for guests in their house. She was making pies.
This is in Venezuela, right?
In Venezuela, in a town called Los Teques. Then there were some leftovers, you know, dough from the edge of the pie. And she decided, instead to throw it away, wrapped a little white piece of cheese and fry them or cook them and eat them up. The guests liked it so much, the word spread around to the next town, to the next town. And by the end, everybody knew what a tequeño was in the whole Venezuela. And if the party did not have a tequeño, it was not a good party. Then my son and my partner decided to take the tequeño out of the party and into the movie theaters.
Well, not yet, though, right? It hasn't come to the U.S.
yet. Not the U.S. This was in Venezuela.
It's like a Venezuelan gougère, if that makes sense. So let's try one.
And there's sauces, too, John, so get ready.
Oh, my goodness.
The sauce options, we got ketchup, we got garlic cilantro, or we've got spicy cilantro mayo.
I tried the garlic. It's really good.
That sound I hear, is that my artery slamming shut, or is it just the noise
very
here?
Very healthy.
Very healthy?
No seas mentiroso, eh?
Okay, well, it's very delicious and tasty first.
Before we roll out, John, you got to try the garlic sauce. It's so good.
Okay, I need one more. What? Oh, my God.
Be brave. Yeah. Be brave. Look at it this way. I'm ditching my juice cleanse for the day, so
one
your arteries can harden.
Enough.
One is never enough?
One is never enough.
Okay, I'm converted. I just have to wait for them to come to my theater.
Oh, we wait. We hope we're there soon.
John, say the word.
Tequecitos.
Oh, you got it!
That sounds delicious.
Good.
And I'm all for more culturally specific snacks coming to mainstream movie theaters. I'd probably eat too many of those.
It's the danger.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Vinette is dying.
She doesn't know, so you can't say anything.
John, it is now time for us to talk about one of my very personal favorite movies of the entire year, which happens to be coming out this summer. It is called The Farewell. Awkwafina, who you might have seen in Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8, stars as Billy, a Chinese-American woman from New York City who goes home with her family to visit her grandmother in China. The grandmother, here's the twist, has been diagnosed with cancer,
but does not know it. Lulu Wang wrote this movie and directed it based on a crazy experience that she had in her own life, where she got a call many years ago that her grandmother was sick.
I said, you know, I'm not looking to cast or to direct an actor to play me. I am looking to create a sympathetic character who is, it's more about her inner journey and her inner struggle. And as long as the actor can connect with that struggle, I think that's what holds the film together. And for Awkwafina, she was raised by her Chinese grandmother. And, you know, she's getting older. And so the very thought of losing her grandmother just would make her burst into tears. And I said, bring that. Bring that to every single scene, whether it's a funny scene, whether it's a sad scene. All you are thinking about is that you are going to lose your grandmother. And so I think that poignancy is something she definitely brought to the movie.
Was there any moment during filming where you're watching Awkwafina act, saying dialogue that you've written, where you have some sort of out-of-body experience, where you start thinking about how you felt when she's saying the words that you wrote?
I thought that it would be more awkward, you know, watching these scenes that, you know, mimic the things that happened in my own life with my own family. But the actors all brought such a unique perspective to it that it became its own thing. And people often ask me, like, what's fictional and what's real in the movie? And to be honest, I'm kind of confused. Like, I don't remember. I'm like, wait, did I write that? Or did the actors bring that particular beat? Or did that actually happen? And, you know, and everybody was hanging out with each other all the time. My parents were both on set, and my mom was hanging out with Diana Lynn, and Tai Ma would, like, go to coffee with my dad, and Tai would be like, did you know this thing about your dad? And I'd be like, no, I didn't know that.
That was Lulu Wang, writer-director of The Farewell, which stars Awkwafina. It is out in theaters on July 12th. Please go see it.
Okay, Jen, the last interview of the show is with Emma Thompson. If you want to be really formal and get her mad, call her Dame Emma.
Duly noted.
Anyway, she plays a late-night television host, and her ratings are declining. She works with a writer's room that's all men. And into her world comes Mindy Kaling, who wrote this movie and co-stars in it. The movie is directed by Nisha Ganatra, and here's what Emma Thompson had to say about making this movie.
This movie is exactly what I want to go and see. It's incredibly uplifting, actually, and it's very funny. And the story's beautifully told and beautifully written. Mindy Kaling wrote a script that was one of those strange things, immediately good. Upon first reading.
How rare is that for you as a reader?
Incredibly rare. Plus, she said, I wrote it for you. So, of course, your heart sinks and you think, oh, this, God, this is going to be bad. It's going to be bad. Because anything that's been written for me, I'm always in a corset being earnest and kind. So, luckily, I wasn't. I was in a blazer with slick back hair being incredibly mean most of the time.
Catherine, do you think women are funny?
Funny is funny.
As long as you're white, male, and from an elite college, like your writing staff.
We need to hire a woman.
The story is about two women who are at work. That's what the story is about and how they interact with one another. And it's very funny, of course, because one of them, me, is blinded by complacency and success and wealth and a kind of monomania. And the other is naive, boundaryless, fragile in a good way and right.
I came to tell you this year is your last.
What?
Who are you?
I'm a new writer.
A new female writer.
Yeah, I can see that, Brad.
It's a great story because the characters are so full of life. You know, when she says to me, you're a bit old and a bit white, that's your problem. You know, my character says, well, what the f- am I going to do about that? You know, I am old and white. What are you going to, come on. So that's the kind of humour. So what I'm saying is that she knitted the politics of her argument into the story with such subtlety that you don't notice it, and yet you know it's right. It lands inside you with this wonderfully convincing power.
There's so much female power behind the scenes and on screen in Late Night that I'm really excited to see it. But I want to also quickly mention some of the smaller movies that might get overshadowed in the studio blitz this summer that you should watch. One for me is The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Beautiful, virtuosic movie that A24 is releasing in June, on June 7th.
I want to mention another movie that played at Sundance in addition to Last Black Man in San Francisco, and that is Loose. It's a psychological thriller that also stars Octavia Spencer from Ma. Very interesting movie, very provocative. It's about a white couple that has adopted a black kid who is maybe a prodigy or maybe he's not.
All right, well, that's it. Thank you for talking summer movies and snacks with me, John.
It is my pleasure. And if you want some of that Cheeto-flavored popcorn,
I might have
some upstairs. It's probably a little stale, but I think that orange coating is, like, bulletproof, so it will probably survive the next zombie apocalypse.
Oh, 1,000%. It lasts forever, right? This special is a production of KPCC in Los Angeles.
It was produced by Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help from Tim Grieving, Marcos Najera, and Julia Paskin. Our engineer is Valentina Rivera. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. And our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. I host The Frame, and you can get that show as a podcast wherever you like to listen.
And I'm Jen Yamato. I'm a film writer at the Los Angeles Times. You can follow me on Twitter at Jen Yamato and find my stories in the LA Times.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at JG Horn. That is it for The Frame Summer Movie Special.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
Now let's go watch some movies and have some popcorn. Yay!
Woohoo!